Joy Austin Lane, and I'm very pleased to present my dissertation findings to you today. This really is more of a macro look. You've heard some really interesting results from the Louisiana tobacco control, and this is more of a macro look at all 50 states where I tried to understand and explain through qualitative and quantitative research the politics of tobacco control funding at the state level. One thing that has helped me validate my findings is for the last 6 years I've been on the city council in Tacoma Park. And so while I've been passing budgets with my colleagues, I have applied some of what I learned through this research. And one thing you'll probably find is I talk much slower than the previous presenters, so hang with me. I really began my interest in the tobacco control arena 10 years ago when I was a policy analyst with the Congressional Research Service. And at that time, Congress was considering a national tobacco settlement agreement that did not pan out, but what the states did instead was the individual settlements, which we know well, in four states, and then the master settlement agreement in 46 states. So for me, as a doctoral student, this seemed like a perfect time to study all 50 states since they were receiving money in somewhat proportional amounts to their population all at the same time. So the basis for my research was just that in tobacco control, as we translate research into practice, money is what is really crucial. And the early stages of that are the state infrastructure as well as the legislative priorities at the state level. And most often the MSA funds went into the general fund. And so state legislatures were vying for, deliberating what to do with those funds, and all of their priorities were part of the mix. There are some constraints that exist in state budgeting. Some that I'm sure you've heard of recently are that states are experiencing deficits and trying to overcome that. At the time when 10 years ago, states were actually in a budget surplus mode, so the MSA just seemed like icing on top of the cake, but really things have changed dramatically over the last 5 to 10 years in that respect. What I have felt is that public health advocates need the tools to operate at this level, and many of them already do, but I thought that it would help to synthesize what was going on in the 50 states and see if I could come up with some determinants of the political decision-making process to offer to those of us in public health who'd like to influence that decision. The scientific basis for policy initiatives is really crucial, but it's like the necessary but not sufficient cause. And so what does add to that is the political and economic picture in states, and I'd like to share with you today the research that I did to identify the important factors in that realm. Not that long ago, governments, ours among them, were promoting tobacco products and supporting the industry's profits. And luckily, we have come a long way in that respect in the U.S. However, the U.S. is no different from other countries where there's a tension between kind of a short-term fix based on an election cycle where legislators need to show results for their work at the state. And then that long-range planning, which in public health is kind of our mission, is protecting health and reducing illness and thereby reducing the concomitant public funding of tobacco-related morbidity. But it is sometimes a tough sell, that short versus long-term approach. Just to give you an overview of what's been going on in state legislatures over the last 30 or 40 years, this is a slide that I borrowed from Gary Giovino, and I thank him for that. It shows that as the as time has gone on, the restrictiveness of state laws has gone up, and you can see that in the 80s, with the even though that was the Reagan administration, you did have more extensive restrictions going into place, and I would say that tracked pretty well with the scientific case that the tobacco control world was putting forward. And then you can also see that in the 90s, the restrictiveness of state laws was up to 50%. And so, you know, many states were participating, and many of them were putting in place policies that were really rigorous to address this problem and curtail smoking. The impetus for my research was that we, as a country, were not reaching reduction goals for tobacco use, and this has been widely studied by the CDC Office on Smoking and Health and put forward in terms of best practices and dissemination of tools to the states and a large amount of federal funding to set up state infrastructure has been part of that history. The Healthy People 2000 and Healthy People 2010 further establish those goals and give us benchmarks by which we can judge our progress. There is a solid case for the effectiveness of tobacco control and the need for it. The state funding for it was really the question and how to make comprehensive tobacco control programs something that were not only a stated priority but a funded priority. And let me just take a step back before I show you my results to give you a little bit of the rationality behind politics. And you can see here a comparison between the non-political rationality, which you know could apply to the scientific world, although some people in graduate departments on the faculty may argue that that's a rational world. The political rationality that you see up there shows that decisions are really based on who supports and who opposes proposals. So for that, you have a large number of special interests who are lobbying continually, and public health advocates, as they do in Louisiana, it sounds like just need to be in that same realm and keeping the communication going and keeping those relationships strong. Another political approach is that actions should not identify with any proposal or point of view, and this is in the public realm that a large degree of independence is required, and the less objective you seem, the less credible and the less viable you might be as a legislator. The next one is the best proposal for something should be deferred, objected to, discussed until major opposition disappears. And this may seem kind of crazy, and some people do say that watching laws being made is like watching sausage being made, and just not something you really want to see. But I would argue, with my behavioral sciences background, that this deliberation process is actually a period where people are coming to terms with the changes that might be made and adjusting and making sure that accommodations are made for their particular concerns. The next is the compromise between a good and bad proposal is rational, and many people think that you know if you can't get the best bill passed, then it really just take your toys and go home. And I would argue that in the legislative arena, that most often something is better than nothing. And things do work in incremental fashion in legislatures. And one thing I heard when I was at the Congressional Research Service was the function of legislatures is not to pass good laws, it's to keep bad laws from passing. And that turning things on its head that way shows that this is an arena where people are bringing together ideas from very diverse viewpoints, and that deliberation process is something very human and very necessary in order for us to keep moving together, keep moving forward together. So I hope this helps orient you to what makes sense in the political realm. And it's not always the one that makes sense in a logic model or a linear fashion. And so, of course, doing a dissertation, you have to have lots of models and theories behind why you're doing what you're doing. This one is from Hofferbert, and the reason I show it to you is because I'm going to show you some complicated findings, and this hopefully will help you clump what I show into just a couple of categories. So in policymaking, you have inputs, environmental factors, stimulating demands, and supports for different policies. Then you have the political process, which those factors churn through, and that has to be sensitive to both the people involved and the politics of that system. You have constitutional frameworks and electoral politics and the party structure, legislative process, and interest groups are also a big part of that process. And then you have the outputs, and that is the public policy, goods, services, or symbols. In my study, that output was per capita funding for tobacco control, and this was a measure that the CDC had tracked by, I think, a firm called Miatech, and they were looking at each state legislature's appropriations bills and identifying the numbers that were allocated specifically for tobacco control, and then reporting that out on a 50-state basis. So that part was done for us. And the part that I contributed was really the trying to understand the inputs and the political process that helped determine that outcome. Here's another model that I found particularly helpful by Hofferbert, public policy theorist, and this shows how you start with the large number of conditions that exist in a state legislature, and everything from history to geography to socioeconomics and recent and past political behavior, as well as the structures that exist and the opinion leaders at the time. And then at a certain point, there is hopefully a result that that you can identify and help explain. Okay, that's enough with the models. Sorry about that. let's see. So what I found when I looked to the literature was that a quantitative model for this was really not possible at this time, and that drove me to do the qualitative portion of my research in order to chart the waters a little bit more systematically. There was a study published by Gross et al. From Yale University, and they tested numerous burden of disease factors in tobacco and really came up with very little. There was a suggestion through that research that state economy, anytime it was linked to tobacco, might be important, and that was something I pursued as well. So just as an overview, the qualitative part was study one, and that's where I identified and prioritized factors and developed a conceptual framework to guide the research. And study two is where I quantified those factors using existing data that was available on all 50 states. I developed a regression model that explained a high degree of variability in the data. My methods for identifying and prioritizing were conducting key informant interviews with experts. And in tobacco control, luckily we have many government agencies as well as advocacy groups and voluntary health organizations that have made this a priority. So there were many experts for me to seek advice from. I began talking with people, doing a structured interview over the phone. They lasted about an hour, and I recorded them and then transcribed them. Participants then let me know, as part of the interview, other people that they thought would be important to talk with. So that snowball sampling was really how I generated the key informants. And then 12 of the 14 interviews were transcribed and coded. I identified from that 26 discrete factors that people felt strongly were important and needed to be pursued. And then I checked the reliability of my scheme by training three independent coders who went through the process of coding the interviews separately and then seeing what percent agreement could be achieved. And the third coder was the one who would break a tie if the first two didn't agree. And what you can see here is that over the 14 interviews that I conducted, you have an accumulation of important factors. So in the very first interview, there were 18, and then 24 and 25 and 26, and that's kind of the guide of when you quit with qualitative research, is when you start seeing repetition. The way that I prioritized these factors was by carrying out a modified Delphi process where I sent the 26 factors randomly ordered on three forms back to the 14 experts. We did this by email and it worked very well. They responded at a very high rate and were invested in finding out the results, which I promised to send them as soon as they were available. So that was really the only trade that existed in this relationship. So they were dedicated to the field and interested in this research as well. What I had these key informants do as part of this prioritization was judge the importance on an 8-point scale of all 26 of the factors and then rank them. And the way that I identified the key factors from these lists were by establishing cutoffs from plots and median values. And this is a framework that has now been published in the journal Health Promotion Practice. It came out in July of 2004, which was approximately 5 years after the Master Settlement Agreement was finalized in 99. It was a special issue that brought together a lot of tobacco control research on the MSA, and I was very pleased that this was included. This was kind of the conceptual layout of what I found, and I'll just talk a little bit about some of the outside influences on state legislatures, the tobacco control funding, which is where the tobacco control and state government worlds intersect, and then the inside influences. And all three of these categories need to be attended to in order to understand and influence that in the future. So outside influences, as you might imagine, are tobacco industry, political activity. Also, you have the state's dependence on tobacco in any way, economically, and then you have advocacy groups, you have the population and how liberal or progressive or conservative they are. You have the media and how well they cover the issues and what angle they take on the issues. You have other states, especially those nearby or those large states in our country that help model for smaller states what is possible and kind of do the trial and error for the smaller states where they most likely can't afford to do anything until it's a little bit more established. And then you have the federal government as well. The tobacco control funding factors that came out of this design were the some states that had dedicated funds that lent itself to higher appropriations for tobacco control. Some states had ballot initiatives where the voters had decided to allocate money for this purpose. And then you have history, so prior policy and prior results of policy initiatives. The inside influences were the budget situation, which is always in flux, the state priorities and what has come before and what the current legislature and the governor say they would like to have happen after. The political culture is different by state for any number of reasons, and that seemed to be something that my key informants used to just summarize differences among states, political culture. So had to be on the list. And then sometimes health department officials and attorney generals were very influential in a state and them earmarking funding for tobacco control. Okay, that's another model. And what I found was that all of these 26 factors were clustered into these three groups which hung together, and that advocacy at the state level was key to appropriations, but it really was secondary to political and economic factors based on how the key informants ranked that as in importance. The key factors were in that conceptual framework that I just went through. And now let me tell you a little bit about the quantitative side of things. What I did with this information was, as I said, looked for data that was available on all 50 states. The research design I used was cross-sectional and observational. I did set out some hypotheses based on the framework that that you know about now, and because the state is the unit of study and my sample size was only 50, any quantitative approach really had to limit the number of factors that went into a regression model. And I thought regression was the best way to pursue this. So I knew going into it that really no more than five factors could be allowed for a stable model. I think I've already mentioned that my outcome of interest was dollars appropriated for tobacco control in state budgets according to the CDC tracking contract, and that was for fiscal year 02, which is 2001 to 2002, and divided by state population. And by doing it this way, I hoped that I would kind of make proportional the states in relation to each other by population. Let's see, the 11, so the next step was in matching the concepts that I had come up with to actual data, and that's probably more art than science, but I felt that I did do it justice. Let me just flip through here. The seven factors that I chose were that there were existing measures for were budget situation, state priorities, the role of the governor, tobacco political influence, tobacco economy, advocacy, and public opinion. And you can see my hypotheses were that there would be a negative or a positive relationship with those factors in the outcome. I will not bore you with that. So you can see that from the 26 factors, there were 18 measures that translated those concepts into numbers. And from the 18, bivariate regression was how I eliminated five. From the 13, collinearity eliminated four more. From the nine that went into the multiple regression model, five of them were important and added to the explanatory value. And here's the final model You can see that my p-values for these factors, oh, actually, let me tell you what the factors are. Sorry about that. As you can see here, GSP is gross state product from tobacco. And this is what I found to be the most important explanatory factor. And it does make sense that a state, even if the government is not receiving revenue from the tobacco industry, the state legislature is keen on keeping the economy stable in that state. And 26 states have some gross state product from tobacco. And this is an economic measure that's tracked and reported every year by the federal government. So that's something that prior to this, many people thought tobacco economy in a state was really about the major tobacco producing states, but 26 of our states, half of our states, have some gross state product from tobacco, and they actually act different in appropriating money for tobacco control than the other 24 states. So that was one of the most important findings from this quantitative research. And the other factors, this might be easier for me to explain the factors to you. So gross state product is the top one. The second one is whether or not a state had a preemptive state law. And as you know, that's where at the state level, the legislature will pass something saying that local ordinances that are more strict are not allowed in that state. Half of states had a preemptive state law, and those states acted differently. Both gross state product and preemptive state laws could be seen as tobacco industry lobbying. The main limitation of my data is that all of these variables are just proxies for what they might be. And let me move on here. The citizen liberalism is the other factor. That was a public policy measure on all 50 states of how progressive the electorate was, and it was based on other policies that existed in that state. And then finally, a very interesting political factor is the role of the governor, which many people said in my key informant interviews was crucial. What I found in the quantitative analysis was the governor's party and the governor's authority were both important to the model when left in together. If the governor was Democrat and a very strong governor, and when I mean say strong or weak, it's really a function of the state constitution. It's not how charismatic they are or how smart. It is how much authority they have to pass budgets and to change budgets and to set priorities and to influence policy in that state. So if you had a strong Democratic governor, it was influential in a positive direction for tobacco control spending in that state. And all five of these factors together explained 49% of the variance in the data, which for a social science project is enormous. Most times, in economics and other fields, you're looking at sometimes hundreds of factors, and you're explaining maybe 10 to 20% of the variance, whereas these five factors showed a very strong relationship with the outcome. I think I've mentioned the limitations. This is an explanatory model because it was used on 1 year's worth of data. And so my next steps are to see whether a predictive model would hold up using these same factors or any of the others that were eliminated along the way. And the regression model, the quantitative findings are consistent with what I learned through the qualitative findings. Four of the seven null hypotheses that I posed were rejected. The explanatory value of the model is clear, and it certainly prompts the need for more quantitative exploration. Let me just make sure I haven't forgotten anything. All right. Future research can focus on exploring factors of interest and testing the model in different budget years and examining whether initiation of funding is different from maintenance of funding. And I think what was spoken about in Louisiana is exactly right, that maintenance of funding is just as active a process as initiation. The thing that future research also needs to do is test these ideas and see whether interventions based on them hold up as well. And I would love to just recognize the people at Uniformed Services University who supported me as I finished this research, and then Terry Pahacek from Office on Smoking and Health at CDC was also on my committee. What we in the tobacco control world hope is that the funding that could be used for tobacco control is not just going up in smoke, and I hope that this this research helps you in your work. Sure. Yeah, that's part of the regression model, and the results will be published hopefully soon. I'm submitting a manuscript to peer review journals and looking for this to be published. So that would probably be the. I think in general the numbers are widely available through CDC, and so the amount of funding is there. To model it, it's just dividing that amount of funding by the state population. And then the other factors that exist, you know, many researchers have been looking for the needle in the haystack, and so a lot of things have been ruled out as helping explain that outcome. But I'd be happy to get you a chart of the numbers if that would be helpful. Yep. So how funding interacts with like preemption and clean indoor air laws and things like that. That's a great question, Michael. I'll think about it and I'll write it up. Other questions? Thank you.